So thanks to the organizers for the invitation to, as he put it, not moderate, but be a discussion leader. I think that's in part because of the impossibility of fully riding herd on our pair of irrepressible panelists. I'm going to introduce them briefly, and then try to just jump to the heart of things, introduce the issue before us, and talk through a couple of the public policy concerns raised. Not using this, so I would turn off the slides if I could, and I ran the class myself, but these are slides for John, one of our two terrific panelists. John Jacobson is a partner at Wilson Sonsini in their New York office, where the firm represents Google, but I understand you don't directly, is that?
No, I represent them all the time, but okay, I'm here on my own nickel.
Got it. So, longstanding leader of the antitrust bar, U.S. versus Visa, Eastman Kodak versus Image Technical Services, a member of the Antitrust Modernization Commission. Richard Epstein, who doesn't want to be introduced at all, is the James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor at University of Chicago, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and starting in fall 2010, a full member of the faculty at NYU Law School, where he's been a multiple year visitor up till now. One of these folks who writes more than I think most of us get around to reading. So, to bring us straight to the Google book search issue. So Google's mission, as has been burned into our brains over the course of the last decade, is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful, in their words. So it's only natural that it would set its sights on the world's books and to pursue an attempt to create the world's universal library. And even better, to radically increase its accessibility and usability relative to any library we've ever seen. So this is an effort that began in earnest in 2004. I think officially it began a few years before that, but it was in 2004 that they really cranked up the scanners and started to wholesale copy the pages of some millions of the books contained in a number of the country's libraries and overseas as well. I think there were at least a couple of overseas affiliates. The following year, 2005, they were sued by a collection of authors and publishers. This was, as you might well expect, a copyright suit, alleging copyright infringement. To radically simplify a very complicated issue, they were arguing, if you copied the entire book page by page, you have violated copyright law, no matter what you do with it. Right? Google's response, it matters a lot what you do with it. That if you use it in certain transformative fashions, if you only make available pieces of it, if you allow the owners of the copyrighted material to opt in or opt out in various ways, this makes a big difference to the copyright analysis. Now, whatever the merits of that, the whole thing's settled, right, so far. So in 2008, the initial settlement was announced. Highly complex. We'll get into some of the complexity in a few minutes. Though, in my view, not excessively so. This may be a settlement that only a lawyer could love, but this is an extremely complicated set of issues. And so the complexity does seem warranted given the different ways in which this copyrighted material could be used, the different uses to which it's been put. Maybe the most ingenious feature of this, and something to keep in mind as you listen to the subsequent panelist, is that it manages to bring in folks who are parties only by virtue of the fact that this is a class action. So the settlement purports to settle everything for all authors, unless they opt out, unless they affirmatively say, no, I don't want to be part of this this litigation, this settlement, I want to take my own way. Now, this matters particularly for the authors that we don't really know about. So, bubbling around among at least copyright academics has been concerns about orphan works. So, these are works that, like it sounds, don't have anybody to kind of take care of them. Now, this creates potentially a big issue if you're trying to, for example, clear the rights to a documentary like Eyes on the Prize, and you have worked with all of these old materials, and now you can't find the folks who actually own the snippet of music you want to play as part of your documentary, or a few frames of video, or a text. Right? If you can't find them, you might be worried that they'll show up suddenly and bring a copyright infringement suit against you. So figuring out what to do about orphan works has been a preoccupation of the Copyright Academic Bar for some time. This purports to clean all of that out to some degree, because all of those orphan works still have authors who are part of the class, and if they haven't spoken up, then they're taken care of as part of this overall settlement. And so the agreements that are reached as part of this arrangement accomplish things that could not be accomplished through straightforward negotiation, absent the litigation that makes possible this whole class action operation. So the settlement has engendered some opposition. I believe hundreds of objectors. It probably depends on how you count them. I'd lump them into two major types, and this is with apologies to the three or four other major types that I'm just ignoring for now. First, antitrust. Second, privacy. A word about each of these, and then we'll turn to the panelists. So with respect to antitrust, the basic issue is that although the settlement does some good, it had or has some unattractive features for consumers, first, and second, for potential entrants, folks who might want to get into the business of being Google with respect to, you know, creating their own competing universal library, perhaps by scanning all these books on their own and then attracting a copyright suit and then trying to get their own settlement, or perhaps litigating that copyright issue to judgment, you know, litigate it to the death instead. So with respect to the first of these consumers, one of the major concerns as to the original settlement agreement was that Google set up, that the agreement provided that Google would set up an algorithm for pricing, that it would figure out what the price for each specific book should be, and it would do this in a way that would maximize revenue kind of overall. Now, this raised red flags for antitrust folks, because they would think, wait, well, you know, profit maximization across all books sounds a lot like price fixing. And having Google work out some complicated algorithm that had this opportunity that looked like price fixing raised a great deal of concern. Second, with respect to potential entrants into the business of sort of being Google, having their own competing libraries, there was what's known as a most favored nations clause. So basically, that means that Google would insist that if the copyright owners wanted to do a deal with somebody else, that's fine. They could do that, but it better not be a better deal than Google was getting itself. Now, there's some sense to this. I mean, Google was the only one that spent a great deal of money.
That sounds ridiculous.
Right. Give me like 45 seconds.
Okay.
And third, that there was a concern that the Norr Pennington doctrine might get in the way, by which I mean, if you have an antitrust issue that is resolved through settlement that's blessed by a judge, you might later have a block to antitrust liability. So these were some of the major issues raised by antitrusters, I would say. As the exclamation suggests, it's very difficult to hide the ball in an audience like this. The revised settlement agreement that was announced a month ago goes a great distance to resolving both of the major issues that I had described. They've clarified that the price-fixing provision doesn't really do that, that each price will be set separately. I do think it's important to mention this because of the great deal of public interest that the settlement as it stood just a few weeks ago engendered. With respect to MFN, they've cleared that out. They've cleared that out as well, and they've waived any claim to Norr Pennington. And so the objections along the lines that I just described, as raised by the antitrust division in a brief submitted to the court that basically sent the parties back to the drawing board, you loses some of its force in light of the revised agreement, and moreover, the fact that the parties have given up any claim to Norr Pennington immunity means that if some antitrust issue arises when the settlement actually takes operation, should it be approved, antitrust enforcers could come in later rather than having to challenge it beforehand. There's a second set of issues that have been raised that I think the amended settlement agreement does less to address, and these are in the area of privacy. Now, Google has repeatedly likened this project, this grand project, to a universal library. In the U.S., though, most states, all but a couple, have state laws that provide privacy protections to the users of library materials, and it's far from clear whether those kinds of protections will apply to the settlement should it be approved. Moreover, much of the consumer interface, once and should this become operational, will run through Google accounts, which is, you know, if you're using Gmail and something else, right, if you're also using Picasa or some of the other applications, you'll have an account that links and integrates some of the information that Google has about you. And so privacy advocates have raised the concern that this kind of integration of information across a lot of different contexts raises issues we've just never really seen before. And the revised settlement doesn't do much to reduce those fears. So with that, I'll turn it over to John, and we'll dive into the more specifics of the agreement.
So Scott has actually covered everything that I was going to talk about, so I'm done. But let me go through some of the background. So the scanning began a while ago. Results of the scans in terms of what were available depended on what sort of book it was. So if the book was in the public domain, and books published before 1923 are in the public domain, books published between 1923 and 1963 might be, depending on if the copyright right was renewed. But if the book was determined to be in the public domain, you could have full access to the book through Google. Why not? All right, so for books that were determined to be in copyright, only snippets of the book were available, and for books that were determined to have ownership rights associated, the only thing that was available was basically Dewey Decimal type indexing information. Well, we've got some examples of that I'll show a bit later. But fundamentally, we had the major institutions other than the University of Chicago who contributed to the scanning project, and the effort was really to create a modern Library of Alexandria, and I think the project went a long way towards doing that. So Google got sued by the Authors Guild, a number of individual authors, the major publishing houses. There was a substantial fair use defense if the position of some people, which is that the case can't be settled at all, we'll get into that, is taken seriously. Google believes that they will prevail on that defense, but as in many litigations, you believe earnestly in a position, but it also makes sense to settle, and that's what's going on here. So there are different constituencies with different interests. There are the library partners that we talked about before, Stanford, Harvard, Columbia, etc. The authors, the publishers, and of course Google. And the initial settlement agreement was reached a little over a year ago, and it was amended last month. So the settlement creates something called the Books Rights Registry, and that organization has the responsibility for representing the authors and publishers for
providing a clearinghouse by which known authors and publishers can either opt in or opt out to certain of the rights, to be able to act on behalf of participating rights holders to license their works if the rights holder agrees to that, and to license entities to unclaimed works. That's the so-called orphan issue. We'll talk about that to the extent legally permissible, and we'll talk about that issue as well. So rather than go through these other bullets, let me go to some of the screenshots. All right, so this is a screenshot of a public domain book on Google search. You can see the whole book is there. You can download the book. You can view all of the text. You can search within the book. The book is freely accessible. For those publishers or authors who have agreed with Google to participate in the partner program, snippets of the book are available. Up to 20% of the book will be available. Full search capability will be provided. There will be links to tell you where you can buy the book, such as Amazon. Amazon was one of the main objectors to settlement. And there will also be advertisements next to the book, like O'Reilly down there, and the majority of the revenues associated with those ads will go to the rights holders. So the library books in copyright, but the author has not come forward. There will be limited snippets of the text are available. There will be searching available. There will be indications where you can buy the book, but the user's rights will be limited. You will not be able really to copy more than a small snippet of the book, and you will just get the limited sort of use that is shown in the screenshot. Now, the settlement, here's some propaganda, but not of our own, but basically Mr. Barton here is saying what I said, which is, you know, we should stand up and applaud because this really is the new Library of Alexandria, and in the interest of time, this is in a handout that I left at the front, and you can read this and either agree with it or disagree. So under the settlement, there will be institutional subscriptions. This is very important. The places like City College or Swarthmore or places that are fine educational institutions but don't have the access or resources to have a library of the sort of Harvard's or Stanford's will be able to purchase an institutional subscription with the revenues going largely to the right holders that will basically provide through online access, full access to all of the materials available at the world's great libraries. Each of the public universities and libraries will have free terminals, no charge, where people will be able to scan the books, look at the books, get the full access provided by Google to these books without further ado. In terms of people who want to buy the books, Google will point users to Amazon and other sources if you want to go buy them. So if to the extent books are sold through this project, 63% of the revenues will go to the authors and publishers through the book rights registry, 37% to Google. It is a split a lot better than Amazon, which is 50-50, 50 of the revenue going to Amazon, 50 of it to the rights holder. But as we'll see, rights holders have the ability, whether you can opt out of the settlement, of course, and then your book isn't available at all, but if you choose not to opt out, you have the ability through the registry to set your own price or to rely on the pricing set by the Google algorithm that Scott decides, that Scott described. And the rights holders, if they want to, can remove. This is whether or not you you opt in. If you opt out, then you're out of this process. But if you're in, you can include those books you want, exclude those books you want. For the books where the author has not come forward, the Books Rights Registry and another entity called the Unclaimed Works Fiduciary have the responsibility of taking the revenues that are associated with those books and using them to attempt to locate those rights holders. And the rights holders have an incentive to come forward because it is free money in every literal sense of that term. So the sense is that the number of books that are unclaimed will drop over time as people decide, gee, you know, this is free money, why don't I pick some of it up? All right, so let's go to the antitrust objections. The principal objections were filed by Amazon and by Microsoft. They have funded most of the other antitrust objections. Have you objected on antitrust grounds?
Well, yes, in part.
Okay. I think it's fair to say that Google has seen no objection on antitrust grounds that was not funded or sourced through Microsoft or Amazon. You may have a number of objections, but I suspect that you are not objecting on antitrust grounds. And as we'll talk about the antitrust objections...
Go ahead.
We're here to have a dialogue. So
no. We're here to have a forward dialogue.
There are antitrust objections submitted by people other than Microsoft and Amazon. The principal antitrust objections are by Amazon and Microsoft. Some of the objections were filed by the Department of Justice. Those were not funded by Amazon or Microsoft. They adopt Amazon's arguments, but they were not funded by Amazon. So you're clearly right on that. One of the things that I think is highly relevant is that Google was not the first to do this. Microsoft and Yahoo both embarked on similar scanning projects, but decided that it wasn't worth it for them to invest the money, so they decided not to go forward. There are lots of objections, but there are lots of charitable and educational institutions that have supported the settlement. Settlement provides access for the visually impaired to books that would not otherwise be available to them. The book provides access, as I said, to small educational institutions that would not otherwise be available. These people have lined up in support of the settlement. I would suspect that although there are many objections, that many of them, as we'll talk about, are based on reasons related to the use of the word Google rather than to the merits of the actual settlement. So, and the antitrust objections have been opposed by a group that doesn't include Richard, but that includes people that I would describe as the far left wing, Einar L. Haig being a friend and colleague who I would not describe as middle of the road, but as much more towards the left side of the spectrum, to the reasonably far right wing, such as William Baumol, another good friend, but who is certainly someone who you would not think of as a hardcore liberal antitruster. So in terms of the antitrust, I'm going to try to go through this quickly because Professor Epstein is going to object to everything I say, and then hopefully I'll have a few minutes to come back and explain why he's wrong. But the fundamental position that we should ask about is, are consumers better or worse off with the settlement than without it? And I think under any analysis, consumers are better off. What antitrust looks to and what consumers generally should look to is there more output? Is there going to be more literary content available for humanity as a result of this agreement? Or is output going to be restricted in some manner that is going to result in an elevation of price? And the answer to that, I think, in this case is quite obvious. So Google benefits because search is the value of search is increased measurably. Google's ability to sell advertising increases as a result. That is why Microsoft does not like the settlement. The settlement makes books available that otherwise would be lost to posterity. The institutional subscription, as I indicated, gives everyone who wants it a library as great as Stanford's or Harvard's. The settlement provides a means for locating the rights holders, a means of distribution, and instead of raising barriers to entry to competitors, it dramatically lowers them. There is nothing exclusive in the agreement. There was a most favored nations clause that was not exclusive. It was is since been removed. The concept was Google spent all this money. Why should someone else who spends none of the money get a better deal? They could get the same deal. But in any event, that is gone. So entry barriers. The settlement identifies the books. It provides a means for those who would copy Google to do so quickly and easily. The ability of Microsoft now, if it wants to change its mind, to go back and do the same thing that Google did is much easier than it was before. The concept that there is an orphan works monopoly is a difficult one to grasp. An orphan work, which is a misnomer, it's an unclaimed work. It's a work that's out of print in which the author or publisher has not come forward to claim the copyright rights associated with that work. Well, why is that? Why are people not coming forward? Is it because there's so much value associated with that book that there's a market to monopolize? But antitrust does not prohibit people from doing this, and that's my point. So these books are being made available. Without the settlement, the books are lost. All right, these are books that, if not digitized and if not made available, are simply going to be lost to posterity. So in terms of contributing to the world body of knowledge, the settlement provides something that was not otherwise available before. We'll talk about this later, but in the interest of time, all right, so price fixing. We can talk about the original settlement or the amended settlement. The objection is really the same, honestly. I don't think the settlement changes anything other than the way the algorithm prices the books, but the original settlement and the amended settlement all have an arrangement under which the authors and publishers allow Google to set the price for their books. Under algorithm A, it's set to maximize total book revenue. Under algorithm B, it's set to maximize individual book revenue. It's not price fixing either way, because in each instance, the rights holder has the ability to price the book any way it wants. There's nothing here that is an agreement to set prices. Each individual rights holder is making its own independent decision. Do I want the book priced by Google, or am I going to price it by itself? So the price fixing objection, although advanced by meaningful people who mean well, is totally bogus in my judgment. I'm going as fast as I can. Another point in terms of the market power that this is supposed to give Google. Google's share of books today is 0.0. The settlement does not cover books published after January 2009. Now, when you think about the bestseller list, go to the bestseller list. How many of the books on the bestseller list today were published before January 2009? Not a whole lot. So in terms of the real market for books, the percentage of value that this settlement covers is very small. And, I'll talk about the class action process later. Let me just say that the alternative of saying that litigation can't be settled is not a really attractive one. So I've been shouted down for using too much time, so I reserve my rights and we'll come back later.
So I don't know if this is going to work or not, but I want to bring us back up to 15. No, you've changed. The analysis, this one. So I want to start Richard off, if I can, with this question. Because to some degree, one could argue that the whole funding question is a red herring, right? That Amazon could agree with DOJ and whoever's funded or not. If the argument is correct, it's correct. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. But they should rise or fall on its success or not. Just as this argument is put forward by Einar's Brief and others. I think Einar's Brief is also... Einar's Brief is supported by Google?
Einar is supported by Google, the people who joined his brief or not.
Right. So, but that doesn't make a difference one way or the other for whether this statement is correct or not as a statement of antitrust law. And the question is, does this settlement lower consumer welfare from what it would be without a settlement? So the question I want us to play around with here, and I hope Richard will give us some tension on this, is this isn't the only way to talk about antitrust, right? Because you could imagine an alternative in which the rule is not, is this settlement better than if they just went away, or is this settlement better than some alternative settlement that could otherwise have been promulgated? And I take it DOJ takes the view that this statement is incorrect as a basic matter of antitrust law. Now, I think there's a fight to be had. I hope there's a fight to be had about whether this statement is correctly put. And I'm hoping Richard might start off with that with respect to antitrust.
Well, I'll start off with that with respect to antitrust. Since it turns out that I'm no longer a free agent. Well, I was actually a member of the objector group on the first settlement, mainly because I was so irritated about the way in which the whole thing was being presented as a fait accompli. But let me just sort of look at this question. I think the right answer to the question, if you're talking about maximization, is that you cannot compare A to B if there's a C in the wings, and if it turns out there's an alternative settlement which is feasible to reach, which increases consumer welfare above and beyond the settlement that is already on the table, then in effect that becomes the baseline with respect to the antitrust laws. I mean, for example, you certainly don't want to say, well, there's no antitrust implication in this, given the last sentence that was raised, that Google Books have 0% of the market, and so therefore they're not a dominant player. What you always have to do in all of these situations is to look forward and see exactly the way the market is going to play out over time. And one of the problems, of course, that you have with this is that it will evolve in ways that are perhaps completely strange, and we don't know whether there'll be other entrants or not. I think the objections to the first round of antitrust examples were actually dead winners. It seems to me that if you give a most favored nation clause to somebody and you're also going to have, therefore, an incumbent, anybody else who wants to come in will not be able to get advantages which cannot be immediately duplicated. So the effect of the most nation favored nation clause would be that nobody could come in at all. The interesting question under this settlement for the antitrust gurus to deal with is the issue as to whether or not when you have a dominant position, this position becomes one that pricing strategies independent of a most favored nation clause can continue to allow you to have that situation, such that the threat to go down towards a more competitive level will in fact be sufficiently powerful that nobody will come in, which is, I think, is what Google is banking on in this particular situation. And so it seems to me that so long as I'm not 100% confident that the new entry strategy can work against the dominant position that they've currently done, I'm not quite sure about the antitrust. On the other hand, I'm not sure in the other direction either, because I do think that there's a very well and established position which says that when you're working on these things, a first entrant into a market taking greater risk to some extent ought to get some kind of a pioneer return. So I think that the willingness to waive the more Pennington objection actually is a useful contribution to this. I do not regard this as being out of the antitrust woods. I mean, if any of you have read Randy Picker's stuff, you also did not sign the brief from the University of Chicago. He was quite hostile to the first section settlement, and coming out just a couple of weeks ago is sort of indifferent and lukewarm with respect to the second one. I want to talk also not only about the antitrust laws, it's about the class action issues and so forth.
And it seems to me that this is a very bad use of a class action, although it's very difficult to find a better form than a terrible form to deal with the problem. Let me state what I think the real difficulties are and why it is, if I were a judge, I would not approve this settlement in this term, even if I was satisfied on the antitrust objections. What happens in these particular cases is that the usual rule with respect to a settlement in a class action has to always be deeply aware of the fact that many of the people who are participating in this are non-voluntary entrants, and to the extent that you're going to bind them or force them to opt out of an agreement which they can't understand, you're really putting a very, very powerful restriction on the way in which they do business. I do not think an ordinary author can understand what the world is going on in this agreement. I do not think that this author fully understands what's going on in this particular agreement. But let me give you what I think to be some of the concerns that I have with respect to it on this side. There is no conflict of interest between authors on the one hand and publishers on the other hand if the only thing that you're bringing suit for is to enjoin something on the grounds that it's a violation of copyright fair use. And in my view, unlike Google, I do not think that this is a close case. To me, the very fact that they are copying this stuff for some particular use is pretty clear that they can't do it unless they get the permission. The fact that they're not going to display it doesn't seem to matter. A huge portion of the value in this particular settlement, which may not be shared with author and publishers under the way in which it's organized, has to do with what is called the non-display use associated with the operation. You take something as trivial about the distribution of hits that take place on a given site. If somebody goes first from one book to another book and so forth, this could be valuable information to an author about what kind of market that he or she is going to face and so forth. All of that stuff becomes, as best I can tell, a Google monopoly under these circumstances, which raises, I think, a serious sort of antitrust form for that. So there's that problem about what they keep out of the settlement. But in addition to this, the settlement could have been quite simply as a settlement, look, there have been past infringements, here are the damages, there are no, going to be no future in systems, here's the injunction, and then stop. And that is what is basically what happens for that. And the great advantage of that simple-minded approach is that it means that any potential conflicts down the road between the authors on the one hand and the publishers on the other are not going to be aggravated by virtue of the way the settlement is done. One of the things that's quite extraordinary about this particular settlement is that there are chronic disputes that take place between authors and publishers with respect to ordinary modes of transaction. I looked at this settlement on the stuff having to do with the registry, and as best I can tell, none of the particular positions that authors and publishers may have in opposition to one another with respect to how these things are done are addressed in this particular case. The registry has a right to file for some kind of a general audit. I do not believe under the terms of the settlement that any individual person can compel either the registry to do the particular audit or can get the particular audit that they want themselves. So there's serious kinds of accounting issues that could easily arise under this thing that have not been fully resolved. There is going to be all sorts of disputes about which kinds of present and future rights may be under these things. These things themselves, I think, might be turn out to be difficult to resolve. So the question is, if in fact you have a settlement, and this is kind of a global question, which purports to be more ambitious by way of settlement than any of the relief that you could have gotten in court, which I think is clear in this particular case, then a set of conflicts of interest come up, which means that the class representatives who were suitable with respect to the settlement in the simple terms are no longer adequate class representative with respect to the way in which these conflicts of interest arise. And I think that somebody basically has to go back and try to figure out, in effect, what subclasses have to be represented, what particular interests that they may have at stake, and so forth. And I don't think that this thing flows as smoothly once that is done as it appears to do with respect to the press. That's the first point. The second point is a takeoff, and I'm not going to be very long on this, of the issue that Scott raised in a slightly different fashion. One of the things, of course, that's peculiarly onerous about this situation is the sort of the nature of the opt-outs that you have to do and the question as to whether or not you could reach informed judgments with respect to the way in which they take place. There is another way in which you can try to exploit the web in order to take advantage of low transactions costs that doesn't involve this. Jonathan mentioned that there are many publishers, thousands of which, in fact, have been willing to sign voluntary partnership agreements with respect to Google. I assume that each of them have been able to adjust their P's and Q's with respect to the individual authors whom they represent, or at least will remain liable to the extent that their settlement with Google constitutes a breach of their agreements with respect to the other parties in question. So what happens is, why not do it the other way? Have the settlement which says you're enjoined, and then let them open up a website which in fact allows people to sign on with respect to those books which are in active use. How would this work? Well, I think there are three classes of books that I'd see, and this is the way in which I think you should structure the settlement if I were the judge. The first thing is with respect to those books which are in the public domain, there's no problem with respect to anybody. There are no rights that you have to clear. You don't need a class action to do this. You could have done this from day one. So everything before 1922, you know, with all the complications and so forth about whether a new edition protects an old edition or whatever is going on, could be done that way. Second is with respect to the orphan works, where in fact there is no particular right holder. I think what Google could do is put a list up there of works that it claims to be orphaned, and then see if somebody wants to bite, let it sit there for 6 months. If nobody comes forward with respect to those things, then my view is they can put those things on, and then what you do is you have some sort of a depository with respect to the revenues that come in there, and that you try to give that fellow not just the rights to collect the money, but also to the extent that there may be sort of legal issues that they can pursue, have greater powers than are given currently to the fellow who has the unclaimed rights, whatever it is, work fiduciary, the UWF, a peculiarly ugly acronym for which I completely deplore, Jonathan. Change the acronym, okay? This is my one substantive reform that I'm positive is right. So we get those guys, and then you get the third class of cases, which are books that are in active play. And it seems to me it's not all that difficult, if you want to play the registry game, to open up a site and say, look, you know, we'd like to come in. So run this thing as through an opt-in. I can guarantee you the contracts that will come on the opt-in will be a lot simpler than the ones that are being done with respect to the opt-outs. People can sign up. You can tell them the kinds of display amounts that you want and give them a royalty amount. People are going to start asking questions and so forth. What will happen? Well, one of the advantages about getting this, which I think will help, is if you have the opt-in, I guess many people will take a standard form contract because, frankly, they don't care much about the royalties. They're relatively small. I often put myself to the frustration of my agent in that category. I'm interested in immortality, not cash. I mean, doesn't bother. But maybe I should be thinking otherwise. But there will be some kind of people who have a rather different view on this subject for which this is there. And if they can't find a way to work through this, what Google will set up is a custom claims office, and it can start to negotiate with that. So the question that one has to ultimately ask under these circumstances is, given the fragility of the conflict of interest problems that I think are incumbent in this particular situation, and given the fact that low transactions costs not only make the opt-out an easier way to do, but also the opt-in much cheaper than would otherwise have been the case, why is it that you'd want to take this class action form and push it? Well, Google wants to say that it's going to be a universal library. Well, clearly it can't be a universal library. They're going to necessarily, given the settlement is only for past books, right, Jonathan, as I take it, in the future you're going to have to figure out some mechanism to go forward with this, and presumably whatever mechanism you could use for books that have yet to be published, you can do it with respect to books that have already been published. So I would prefer, in effect, to try to be a little bit more respectful of autonomy, get the transactions cost under control by other devices, and not put together a settlement which, it seems to me, is glaring in its omission, namely the one to deal with the question of how it is that author-publisher disputes ought to be resolved within this particular framework. Therefore, it's not that I'm opposed to getting the orphan works on there and so forth, but remember, what Scott said is the right question. You can take this settlement and divide it into different components, and the fact that the aggregate settlement manages to advance social welfare doesn't prove that each of the individual components of this thing maximizes social welfare. What you ought to do is to look at it component by component, and I guarantee you, the moment you reject this settlement with respect to books that are in active play, i.e. those which are not either in the public domain or those books which are not in some sense, you know, really bona fide or orphan works, what happens is the incredible energy that Google has had to put this thing together will be redirected to try to bring those other authors in. They're never going to get this thing to be universal, but they know and authors know that there's a lot of attractiveness to going there. So I would turn the thing exactly on its head, and I'll end on this note. If the gains from trade are as large as Jonathan says, and I suspect that they are, then the opt-in situation will not be a barrier to getting a fairly large and comprehensive settlement, and it will get rid of the uneasy stain of illegitimacy that's always associated with an over-aggressive use of a class action. Thank you.
John?
No,
let him give him a few minutes.
All right. So I want to respond briefly, and since I talk at about 1/8 the rate of Richard, I'll only hit a couple of the points on which I suggest that he's wrong. First of all, this is the right question as a legal matter. The Sherman Act prohibits contracts in restraint of trade. It does not prohibit contracts that would be less in restraint of trade if we did it some other way. So that's just simply not the law. So, and I think we're all in agreement that the settlement as a whole, and we'll talk about whether you can parse it piece by piece, increases consumer welfare to a level higher than it was before the settlement agreement. All right, so the next question raised is, well, why shouldn't we parse the settlement and look at it chunk by chunk and approve it piece by piece? And the reason you can't do that, respectively, is that it's a settlement. It's an agreement. It has trade-offs. There are some issues on which Google got what it wanted. There are many issues on which Google did not get what it wanted. There are some issues on which the authors and publishers got what they wanted. There are some issues that didn't. The agreement is considered as a whole. If you take out one chunk, you may take out the consideration that the authors and publishers thought they were getting. They may want to say, well, with that chunk taken out, there's no deal. So it's not right to take it piece by piece. The settlement will either be approved or disapproved as a whole, or approved or disapproved on condition of certain amendments, and that's the way it should be. The parties will have a right to reassess at that time. All right, now, is this a bad use of the class action device? Well, if a class were certified for past damages alone, then that case might be resolved on that basis. But when has a court ever said that without looking at the requirements of Rule 23 for the non-lawyers, that's the class action rule, I can say a priori that I'm not going to settle a class for injunctive relief when that is what the parties to the case want to achieve? So this is an agreement that the parties reached. It is forward-looking. There is the ability of people to opt out. If you don't understand it and you don't like it, opt out of the settlement. Everyone knows about the deal. It's not like it's a big secret. Lots of objections have been filed. Opting out is easy. You file a little piece of paper that says no. So now, is this true that the settlement gives more relief than Google could have gotten had there been no lawsuit to begin with? And that is fundamentally wrong, because if a class is not certified at all, then Google can do the scanning and the publish the snippets in the way it has. And the only constraint on that will be the ability of individual authors and individual publishers to maintain non-class action cases against that, which would be an enormous use of social resources to no particular good. The reason we have a class action device is to allow multiple claims to be aggregated so that they can be settled in one fell swoop. So I've used more time than I should have, but those are...
Yeah, you want to do it?
Can I have a one-second response?
No, you can work it into whatever the first question is, right?
First question.
So we'll take questions. Yes, ma'am.
There's something... Mark von Harris, there's something that's been niggling at me.
With regard to class actions, it's my understanding that you're supposed to give notice to all members of a class. When you have orphan works, by definition, you haven't given those people notice unless there was some kind of publication that did the job. How did you get past that?
Why don't you start and then you respond?
So Rule 23 basically says, with the judicial interpretations, that you provide the best notice available. So there are lots of class actions with multiple class members where it's simply not feasible or practical or even possible to send everyone something to mail. So best notice possible often does mean publication. In this case, publication notice was used for those authors and publishers who could not be identified.
The publication issues, I don't think, is the difficult issue. The difficult issue in this class is to try to take the rules for agreements that are unanimous and apply them to those agreements where there's conflicts and only representation. And so, you know, this is not a settlement where everybody agrees. It's a settlement where key representatives agrees and everybody else is going to be bound. And so the hard question, which has been a difficulty in many cases, is what sort of notice and what sort of powers that you have in settlements to achieve things. And in some cases, I'm quite sympathetic with using settlements to get comprehensive results. For example, if you go back and you look at the asbestos settlements, trying to use it through a grid seemed to me to make some degree of sense, and that was struck down by the Supreme Court, which suggests that this might be struck down. When they did the Biox settlement, they didn't do that. They did permissive joinder tactics, and they got the lawyers to say they wouldn't represent anybody who was playing against it. But I don't think that when you get to this particular stage that you want to say is that you can't, unless you're willing to accept a settlement which is crazy, if you think it's crazy, you can't use a class action to get a simple injunction. And I think that what we have to do is to make sure that the rules on settlement, when they're dissenters and disagreements on all sorts of issues, are not treated as though they're valid contracts, but is treated as though they're very precarious social constructions. That's the disagreement between Jonathan and myself.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Yes.
State your name. As I understand, the copyright...
Oh, please state your name and then your question.
Harry Lewis. I'm a member of the Federalist Society here in New York. As I understand it, a copyright is a legal monopoly provided for in the Constitution and then, of course, through the copyright statute. And it looks to me like this is a kind of walled garden technology developed by Google that is supposed to encompass and adjudicate, in effect, through this process of negotiation you described, the rights and liabilities with respect to this allocation of monopoly created by the United States Congress by statute as authorized by the Constitution. Why isn't, what I don't understand is, why is this an appropriate balancing, which has already been accomplished by the Congress in the statute, and which this consent decree by a federal court seeks to supplant? Aren't you really trying to replace copyright law with this sort of comprehensive consent decree based upon a new technology?
John, do you want to tackle that?
So one,
can you hear me? So one of the problems is that neither the Constitution nor the Copyright Act have anything to say about digital rights. And one of the objections that has been made is that you shouldn't resolve this. You should have this lawsuit hanging out there ad infinitum, and let's wait for Congress to act. And I would think that the Federalist Society, at least, would be a good place to acknowledge that that is waiting for a Godot that is unlikely to come.
The copyright statute does provide for digital rights, perhaps inadequately, but they are provided.
Yeah, yeah.
Does not address the issues.
I mean, this is, I think, that part, at least, I'm reasonably confident I disagree with. The real issue is that the copyright right is a very strong right, which gives you the right to an injunction as well as in damages. What the Google settlement is trying to do is to say that the right, which used to be a property right, is now converted into a liability rule. We'll take this thing from you and give you just compensation instead. This is not a new and novel technological problem. This is a standard difficulty with all this stuff. At this point, the issue is actually the eBay case coming back to haunt you. because eBay and essentially said, in the cases of discrete and powerful patents, that we're going to deny injunction as a matter of right and start giving you various kinds of damages one way or another. And one of the reasons why people like myself have always been somewhat apoplectic about that particular decision is that the compulsory licenses with respect to patented technologies are a vast inferior to what you're getting here. The question that you have on the copyright side is whether or not the complexity of the license is one that is accurately captured by the Google agreement, given the wide variety of people who are under the form. And I have to say, I'm not persuaded that they've done that right in terms of submarkets and classifications. And it's not a question, I think Jonathan's wrong about this, to say that you got to wait for Congress to act. Google wouldn't wait for Congress. If they could get two-thirds of their library, they would do it immediately, and immediately they would start going out trying to solicit everybody on the web in their vaunted technology to get additional people in, and I predict that they would succeed. So it's the question of which method do you think, and if the transactions cost are wildly asymmetrical so that contracting in becomes prohibitive and contracting out becomes plausible, okay, I'd understand this, but I just don't see the asymmetries. I think, in effect, contracting in this particular case would work pretty well. Standardized agreements would probably dominate for low-value copyrights, and they would not dominate for high-value copyrights. You would get rid of the stain or the challenge or the uneasiness with respect to coercion on the one hand, and with respect to class actions on the other hand, if you flip the thing over. From Google's point of view, I think this is not actually helping them in the goodwill department. They are going to sort of have a reputation of being an iron fist inside a not all too velvet glove with respect to this. And so I think, in effect, from their own point of view, they should do it. And my guess is the strategy actually is a little bit more complicated than we've said. I think the longer this thing drags on, and there'll be an appeal and so forth, the more apparent it is to Google that getting the voluntary agreements en masse in the interim is the dominant strategy. And I hope that they succeed in that, at which point this whole thing will go away. So that's my view as to how this thing ought to work.
I need a brief. I mean, there was so much wrong in that. Let me just. And the problem is that there's so much that's difficult to respond to all of it, but let me hit a core point. Google worked with Congress for years in support of amendments to the copyright legislation to address the issue of digital rights, to secure the ability of artists and publishers to know when digital rights are not stated in the agreement, who succeeds to those rights. They're very, very serious gaps in the Copyright Act. Google worked for years to try to resolve these, and only on the failure of multiple efforts at litigation did it wind up in the situation it is now. So to say that it should do that is just wrong.
You said that
in 12 other things.
No, I said 12 other things. What I said, in effect, is if they can't get anything through Congress, they will go through private order.
Works were not a problem.
Sorry, so to take it...
Okay, what statute?
I'm sorry.
Let him run the show.
I'm sorry, please. If we could just take a step back here, perhaps in the interest of cooling things off slightly. One of the things that's interesting to see here is what's old and what's new here, right? We have, on Google's part, an alleged or arguable infringement in an area where the law is uncertain that results in some kind of accommodation, some kind of new modus vivendi. We've been here before in some respects. The birth of the recording industry had this feel to it in certain respects. The birth of the cable industry, among others, also had this feel. Now that much.
But the
straight allegation of copying that lays out a arguable direct copyright infringement that may or may not be an actual infringement once you really get to the bottom of it is what I think these situations share. And I'm not sure the software, although software raises some analogous issues, I don't know if it raises them quite as directly. The contrast I want to raise here, though, is here we ended up with a private accommodation rather than a new statute. Now, we, in a sense, have been here before, too, and this is what I'd love to get your all's reactions on. To some people, both proponents and maybe some opponents of the settlement, this feels a little bit like BMI. So BMI is a kind of old case, a staple for antitrust scholars. It's a favorite case to talk about. It's a collective rights organization, right? They're the folks that, together with ASCAP and others, monitor people singing happy birthday, more realistically, people playing songs on the radio or in restaurants to collect money and hand it back to rights holders.
Big difference. Now, that was a consensual organization.
Lynn, please.
In my defense, she's now one sentence ahead of me rather than 45 seconds ahead of me. One difference between these situations is that that was an antitrust decree. And so one of the things I wonder about, and I wonder if either of you guys would react, is this a lot like BMI or not? To the extent that our rules for this Google Book Settlement-like procedure in music are run under antitrust decree, can we expect to see, you know, 5, 10, 30 years hence, you know, Danny Chen, by then on the Second Circuit, holding on to this case in the district court, working out the fourth revised settlement agreement and, you know, maintaining order in that sort of quasi-public, quasi-private way?
I think if this is going to be a consent decree, it's going to be a continuing consent decree. I don't see any way to avoid that. But I don't think that the analogy to BMI is exactly right or instructive. What BMI is great at doing is monitoring standard radio uses for which a standard fee is appropriate and then getting the divisions. One of the things about the settlement, which is why I don't think there's any problem, is in that particular case, direct negotiations are always allowed between the songwriter or the composer and the individual fellow. As best I can see, this agreement makes that much more difficult, maybe impossible to do, but that, I think, could be amended one way or another. It's not that clear to me, but the registry is I think in some sense, is a more powerful intermediate than is going on. If, in fact, you know, in addition to opting out, you could actually have direct rights of action against Google for its various infringements, that might make it an otherwise a different situation. But I would rather, in effect, given that the transactions and the technology is so different today, if, in fact, you get the orphan works and you get in there subject to revision and you get the works in the public domain, all right, so you can't have a settlement in half, but you just amend the settlement in this particular fashion to get those things out. I just think that last mile, you're going too far and getting too little from it.
John, what do you think?
I don't think it's like ASCAP. I do think there will be some...
Here's the mic, please.
There will be some interstices in the settlement that will require some monitoring going forward. I don't think it's going to be a 40-year process. I think there are certain basic things that are going to have to be ironed out that are not anticipated. I do want to respond to what I view as either a mistaken or uninformed comment that it's difficult for authors individually to set the price here. Each author and publisher is going to have a dashboard in which it will, for all of its works, be able to indicate whether the book is in or out, and for each of the books, what the price is. It's hard to imagine anything easier than that.
I think we have time for one more question. Yes, ma'am, in the back.
Kishana Kali. This is more aimed to Professor Epstein, but I guess I'm wondering, you mentioned that you don't think the class action device is a particularly appropriate way to get these rights adjudicated and settled among these various types of authors. And I'm wondering, with respect to the orphan works, why you can avoid the class action device by view of a settlement, given that the value of the claims is so little, and this settling small claims is typically what class actions do. If you have a legislative solution and folks want to challenge that, the little value of their claims is going to make it more likely that they'll challenge it through the class action device anyway.
My view about it, I'm happy keeping the orphan works in. I said there were three types of cases. Public domain works are no complication. Orphan works, you just run them, put the residue in some sort of a fund, and when the claimants come forward, you put it there and you give it to them, or give it back, I don't care to whom afterwards. It's the works which are in active play for which I think we could do it the other way, and I would put the point in the opposite direction. We've got these wonderful charts that Google could put up. They could put them up for every book right now and just set the default in the opposite direction, and at that point you avoid all the difficulties associated with class actions. You're not going to be getting into the trouble with respect to the disputes between publishers and authors, which may in fact be glossed over in the settlement. So it seems to me that you'll get there about the same way. I'm not trying to stop Google from doing its business. I think, however, if you do it in this reverse fashion, the the autonomy issues disappear, and those are going to be very acute in this particular case. The accounting rights and a bunch of other stuff that Lynn has referred to elsewhere, I think, are serious issues. They're not addressed in this particular settlement. The moment you have to put up and sort of get your case in there, they are going to be addressed, and I think that will lead to a better process. So, I mean, this is a relatively small disagreement, but obviously it makes a big difference at some point. Otherwise, Google would not be fighting as hard as it is. And I guess as an author, my attitude is I think they want too much, and I would just wish they'd back off a little. I'm quite happy to sign away my rights, as, you know, I would sign on there, given the paltry royalties that all my immortal texts have generated. But I don't...
I should be let Ron...
Yes, but I think that's all I do. I just...
Yeah.
Just one quick one, which is the default is just what you said it should be. The default is that an in-copyright book is excluded. The author has to opt in for the book to be included. So it's just what you suggested.
That's good. I was wrong. We do have time for another question or two. Yes, sir. Directly in front of the camera.
Dan Dolgen. I'm just wondering whether we don't have, at best for Google, a Pyrrhic victory here. I'm not quite sure I understand the economics that they've put themselves in for. If they win on the substantive copyright issue, which they're going to litigate whether they like it or not with the many people whose work has been copied and will not opt in, then they have a free reign to do whatever they want. The issue goes away. If they lose, doesn't Google go out of business? At $150,000 statutory penalty per violation, and millions of works that they clearly knowingly copied, whether or not it's a violation, the law will ultimately be cleared up one way or another. Multiplied 150,000 times the millions of works, I don't think Google and everybody else in the business could pay the damages. So I don't quite understand what the upside is in Google here, unless I'm misunderstanding what happens in this.
You John, you want to start that?
Yes, absolutely. Please, Joe.
All right. So, For those that opt out, I think Google will have to decide whether to continue those cases or not. My suspicion, if it were me, and they haven't asked me my advice on this, I would simply take the book down and not worry about it further.
But the statutory penalty doesn't depend on how long they keep the book up. Multiply the 150 statutory penalty times the books, they're out of business.
I wager that when we're here next year talking about the consequences of the approval of the Google book settlement, that Google will still be in business.
Oh, I'm sure about that. I still have another question. If the default is set the way you like it, why do you care about the settlement with respect to the new books? I mean, that's what I don't get. You must be getting something. And I think it's the non-display rights, perhaps, that are interested, or that you get rid of certain other, you think that many people will sign on who have not fully informed about what's going on, and so therefore you'll be rid of certain complexities. If, in fact, the default is as you would like it, why not just, instead of my agreeing with you, why isn't it that you don't agree with me? Tell me what it is that you get, which means that you can't take my approach, and just forget about the settlement and do it on a piecemeal basis, since that's the way the default is. I don't understand what is interest to whom that I don't know about. That's what I'm worried about.
Organizing the world's information in a way that makes it accessible to as many people as possible.
But that goes either way.
I don't think so.
Well, that's what I don't
know. Yes, sir, in the back.
My name's Bob Weintraub. I'm a lawyer, but I don't have a dog in this fight.
Neither do I.
And, I have a question on screen 12 about settlement provisions. You know, it talks about that public libraries, in effect, can purchase institutional subscriptions, as I read it. And so I can go into my local public library in whatever community I live in. If I, you know, if I live in the city, it's a little different. But if I lived in the suburbs, go into Scarsdale Public Library or the Belmore Public Library in Long Island, what's an institutional subscription going to cost a local public library in one of the suburban villages?
So the first screen is it the first screen is free, but subsequent screens? There's some provision for making some of this available freely. Is that right?
So for public libraries that participate in the program, at no cost, there are four free terminals give you access to everything. Depending on the size of the library, there may be more, but for the smallest libraries, there will be four free terminals. In terms of the institutional subscription, the anticipation is that something that will be purchased by universities to provide greater access so that students in their dorm room can just hook on through Wi-Fi and get access to all of the books available on Google Book Search in their dorm rooms rather than having to go to one of the terminals in the library.
But I'm sure
there will be a cost for that. I have no idea what it will be, except that Google is not doing this to make money on selling books or institutional subscriptions. Google is doing this to make search more valuable. And
we can be sure that University of Chicago will get a very good price on all of this, right? Yes, sir.
Louis Catrona. What is being negotiated then for the libraries for Google is the right to put four terminals in that will have Google advertising along with it. Is that correct?
When you use Google Book Search, there will be ads on the right side, yes.
Okay, so in effect, this is granting Google a monopoly not only to use these works, but all works, and I think this is the elephant that's being paraded across the stage while we argue about the mouse. Google then has the right to control access to all of the books that are no longer in copyright. And in return, they get the ability to put advertising in everybody's face. So take it from there.
All right. So no one controls the books that are no longer in copyright. Those are universally accessible.
How?
Microsoft, because they're not in copyright. So
no, the digital form.
So what Google has done, the reason that this makes entry easier, is that Google, through this program, has identified those books. You can find them now through the Google process so that Microsoft can go in and free ride on Google's efforts and make copies of the same books that Google has already scanned.
So I submit to you that if one is a university library, that one is not about to grant every Tom, Dick, and Harry the right to come in and scan the books which have already been scanned by Google.
So I think
we're giving a Google a privileged position. Go.
So I think leaving the audience, given this audience, with the last word is probably an appropriate one. Thank you so much for joining us, and please thank our panel.